I'm Ben Cunningham.
And I'm Becky Cross.
Welcome to December's episode of Our Science, the Royal Society's monthly podcast. This month, we're celebrating a special date in the Royal Society's calendar and hearing from a grand total of four Nobel Prize winners.
December is an important time for the Royal Society. The first Society meeting was held on the 28th of November 1660, following a lecture by Christopher Wren. 2 years later, in 1662, King Charles II granted the first Royal Charter, setting the date of Anniversary Day on the Feast of St Andrews, the 30th of November. Each year, we celebrate the anniversary of our founding on this day.
The anniversary meeting includes a director's review of the year, the presentation of the Royal Society's medals, and the President's address to the Fellowship. This is an opportunity to note scientific highlights of the previous year and comment upon important scientific issues.
2015 was a special occasion as it marked the end of Sir Paul Nurse's term as president. Sir Paul Nurse has been president of the Royal Society since 2010. He's director of the Francis Crick Institute and a Nobel Prize-winning geneticist.
In his last anniversary address, Sir Paul Nurse gave a speech on ensuring a successful research endeavour. Here's a clip of Sir Paul's speech in which he reflects on why we do research.
Now, my first question is, why do we do research? Now, research in the sciences, medicine, mathematics, technologies, arts, and humanities all produce knowledge that enhances our culture and our civilization and can be used for the public good. It is aimed at generating knowledge of the natural world and of ourselves, knowledge that can be developed into useful applications, including driving innovation for sustainable economic growth, improving our health, our prosperity, and the quality of our lives, and maintaining the environment. These applications have always been the case since the beginning of modern science in the 17th century, when Francis Bacon argued that science improved learning and knowledge, which leads to the relief of man's estate. Today, for advanced nations such as the UK to prosper as knowledge economies, scientific research is absolutely essential, both to produce that knowledge and also the skills and the people to use that knowledge. And that is why science should occupy a central place in government thinking. If the UK is to thrive in our increasingly sophisticated scientific and technological age. However, scientific research is not solely utilitarian. It generates knowledge that enhances humanity more generally. In the words of Robert Wilson, director of the Fermilab Particle Accelerator, when asked by the US Congressional Joint Committee on Atomic Energy whether the accelerator in any way involved the security of the country, he replied, "It has to do with the dignity of men, our love of culture. It has nothing to do directly with defending our country, except to help make it worth defending." This address is my last formal duty as President of the Society. I want to thank my fellow officers, the Executive Director, successive councils, fellows and foreign members of the Society, and all the Society staff who work behind the scenes for all their help and all their support during the last 5 years. It has been a privilege to serve the Society as President. And I want to wish my successor, Venki Ramakrishnan, the very best of luck for a highly successful and highly enjoyable presidency. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Next up, we speak to the brand new Royal Society President, Venki Ramakrishnan, who began his post on the 1st of December and will be the 61st President of the Royal Society.
Venki shared the 2009 Nobel Prize in Chemistry with Thomas A. Stites and Ada E. Yonath for studies of the structure and function of the ribosome.
In a first for the Our Science podcast, we catch up with the President on what makes him tick as a researcher and what he wants to achieve in his 5 years in office at the Royal Society.
I'm here with Venki Ramakrishnan, the newly sworn in President of the Royal Society. Thank you for joining us on Our Science this month, Venki.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by asking you about your research. Despite being president of the Royal Society and deputy director of the MRC Molecular Biology Lab in Cambridge, you also head up a group of scientists and you're still a practicing researcher. What motivates you to continue to research despite having all these other commitments?
Yes, I have to say my primary thing as a scientist is to do research. And I think what motivates me is what motivates all scientists, which is the desire to find out the answer to questions you're interested in. And I think, you know, Richard Feynman said it best. You know, he has a book which is called The Pleasure of Finding Out Things, or Finding Things Out. And I think that's really what motivates all scientists. And of course, we're aware that much of what we do might eventually become useful. And of course, if we see a use for it, it would be irresponsible not to at least point out that it could be useful and then maybe collaborate if interested. But ultimately, I think scientists are driven by this quest for knowledge.
You've won a Nobel Prize in 2009. And I wanted to ask you, how did it feel?
Well, the thing is that when you do the sort of work that might qualify for a Nobel Prize, other people sort of point this out to you long before you actually get it. And in some ways, that's not so helpful because it's a psychological distraction. I mean, these awards are slightly a psychological distraction because the real focus is on getting your next experiments done and your next paper published. And I had sort of given up on the idea that I would win a Nobel Prize because it had been years and years. Well, not that long, actually, but, you know, it felt like a long time. But anyway, it was a big surprise when I got that phone call. And at first, I didn't really quite believe it. In fact, I thought it was some sort of prank. But in the end, you know, it does feel good that your peers in the scientific community think of you as worthy of the award. I mean, that is probably one of the most satisfying feelings that a scientist can get, is that one's peers think well of your work.
And another large accolade you've been recently awarded, or you recently taken up post as the Royal Society's president. And you're following in the footsteps of people like Newton and Pepys and Rutherford and, of course, Sir Paul Nurse. And how does it feel to be the new president of the Royal Society?
Well, it's not very helpful to think of all your precedents. I mean, Paul Nurse has done a superb job as president of the Royal Society, and they're very hard shoes to fill. But I think we all have to do our own thing. We have to, you know, give it our best shot. I mean, you could argue that the Nobel Prize was given to people like Einstein and, Dirac and people like that, or Linus Pauling in my field. But you know, you can't suddenly feel intimidated by that. You just have to be yourself and do your best. I think that's the attitude I have.
I think that leads us on very neatly to my final question to wrap up our chat today. I think the longest serving Royal Society president was Joseph Banks, and I think he served for 42 years. These days, our presidents have a 5-year term.
Yes, partly as a result of Joseph Banks, is my impression.
What do you hope to achieve in your 5 years here?
Well, the Royal Society, I've found over the last few months, since I started educating myself about its activities, already carries out a huge number of activities, and it's almost anything I thought of. It turns out the Royal Society already has an active program. But if I were to sort of focus on a few things, I would say one is to place science as central in our society. And one reason is that we live in an increasingly scientific and technological world. That is, what science and technology do now have large consequences throughout society. And so decisions are constantly being made by governments, by corporations, by other bodies that affect everyone. And so there are two aspects to this. One is that science should be supported because it is you know, first of all, it's part of our culture. Britain should be as proud of its science as it is of its history and literature and all those other things. And map making and exploration, for instance. But so it should be just as proud of its science and its scientists. And so it's part of our culture. It's part of a human endeavor, a quest for knowledge. And everyone should be excited about it. And the public in general should feel excited and should be aware of what's going on today as well as what went on in the past. And government, of course, you know, luckily I believe that governments of all parties in the UK have been aware of the importance of science. But it's important to continue to support science and to continue to support it at a level at which science can flourish. Because over the long term, ideas and innovation are much better drivers of economic growth and progress than any other thing. You have countries without very many natural resources, which are doing very well because they've invested in innovation and knowledge and so on. And so that's also important. So I'd like to engage more with both the public in terms of awareness of science and enthusiasm about science, as well as government in terms of providing support for science. A second area is international relations, and this is because a lot of science is now global. For instance, issues like energy, the environment, treaties, for instance, about various sorts of things. They all involve international community, and science, of course, knows no boundaries. Discoveries are made all over the world and affect all of our science. And so we need to make sure that we engage with scientists around the world, and this means perhaps through scientific organizations around the world, and especially bringing scientists from around the world together, particularly scientists from developing countries who don't have much of a chance to engage with international scientists. So that's another goal. A third is that the fellows of the Royal Society are among the best scientists in the world. And I must say I was guilty as well in this respect, and that is that it would be great if more fellows were to be actively engaged with the Society's activities, because I think the Royal Society is a force for good. It is, you know, after all, it's for the promotion of science, both for the advancement of knowledge and for what's historically known as the relief of man's estate, in other words, for the benefit of humanity. So I think, you know, fellows should be encouraged to engage more with the Royal Society in whatever activities they like to do. And a fourth is to influence science education. I think we need to be sure we're both creating a scientifically literate population so that they're aware of the issues and aware of science and knowledge. And we also need to train the next generation of scientists well, because other countries are doing this, and we shouldn't be. British science is very good, but we shouldn't be resting on our laurels. And so I think we need to figure out how to improve science education, which is often taught as a rote collection of facts, you know, to be memorized. You meet so many people in the humanities who say, oh, yes, I never really liked science, and so I, you know, went off and did something else. And actually, science is very exciting. It's about exploration and, you know, critical thinking and so on. So that's another goal.
Many of the Royal Society's medals were awarded at Anniversary Day. However, our Premier Awards were presented at a special dinner in October. This event celebrates the winners of our Copley Medal, Royal Medals, Bakerian Medal and Lecture, and Croonian Medal and Lecture.
The Copley Medal is the oldest scientific prize in the world and our most prestigious medal. We were really lucky to get to speak to this year's winner, Professor Peter Higgs. He tells us what it was like to be at the centre of the discovery and announcement of the Higgs boson, and how he's now used to having his selfies taken.
So we're here today with Professor Peter Higgs, who has kindly agreed to be interviewed for the Our Science podcast. So Professor Higgs, could you tell us why you're here today at the Royal Society?
Well, I'm here because the Royal Society has seen fit to award me its oldest medal, the Copley Medal, dating back to 1731. It's believed to be the world's oldest scientific award, and of course I'm really thrilled to receive it.
Excellent. So I'm sure all our listeners would love to know, could you tell us what it's like to be part of the discovery of the Higgs boson, and tell us about that?
Well, the occasion at which the discovery claim was announced at CERN in it was July 4th, 2012, it was quite an amazing experience. I arrived having changed my plans. I'd been in Eritrea in Sicily at a summer school, and I'd thought that the announcement wouldn't be made for several months, but I was told that if I didn't come to CERN for the seminar, I would probably regret it. So I changed my plans and went to Geneva, and I was there, in fact, a couple of days before the announcement. And first of all, I discovered it wasn't safe to eat in the CERN cafes, because I got people queuing up for my signature and selfies and so on. And then on the day before the actual announcement, there was actually some interviews done by the CERN audiovisual people, and to get my reaction to what was to be announced the next day, I had already a copy of the press release, which would not be released till the next day. It wasn't very detailed, but it gave me an idea that it was going to be exciting. So that was the next thing. And then the day of the seminar, outside the lecture theatre, people had been sort of sleeping on the floor overnight, waiting to get in, and the media were there in force, and I was being looked after by the STFC's liaison team at CERN, and Jane McKenzie of that group did a wonderful job at getting me safely from one room to another through the paparazzi. And then there was the seminar itself, and of course, one after another, the spokespersons for the two experiments presented their results, and they agreed, and they had five standard deviations discovery claim, and Rolf Hoyer said, "Well, I think we have it," and pandemonium broke loose. It was like the end of a football match, with people standing up and cheering.
It must have been an amazing experience.
It was an amazing experience.
Wow. So how does it feel for you personally to be at the centre of something that's captured the imagination of the public? You talk about people queuing up for selfies.
Well, the ones in the CERN cafeteria were of course mainly physicists who were working there. But of course, it's since I became as notorious as I am now, I get stopped once or twice a day on the streets of Edinburgh when I go out shopping and so on, and asked for a selfie or an autograph or something. It's calming down a bit. I was amazed by the amount of public interest. I think that the CERN Information Office did a tremendous job of publicity in advance for how important this was going to be. In fact, I was quite worried before the discovery that they were emphasising this one so much that when it happened, various people, including those with political power, would say, OK, well, we've done it now, so we don't need that expensive machine anymore. But fortunately, the Information Office got in time with information about the next stage, so it hasn't happened.
keeps going, it'll keep going.
But it surprised me that the public would have reacted the way they did to this particular thing.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us. It's really been appreciated.
You're very welcome.
In October of this year, we met up with another Copley Medal winner who won this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry, Professor Thomas Lindahl. He told us about his research into DNA cell repair, as well as his taste for fine wine.
Dr. Lindahl, thank you so much for agreeing to speak to us this evening. You're already well known to the Our Science audience as the 2010 recipient of the world's oldest scientific prize, the Royal Society's Copley Medal, and just last week you were awarded undoubtedly one of the world's most prestigious prizes, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. What was your sort of initial thought when you got that phone call last week to tell you you'd won the prize?
Well, I switched over to speak Swedish from English, and that convinced me that the person I was talking to was real. and it sounds
like quite an exciting time.
It was, that's right.
You've shared the prize with Paul Modrich and Aziz Sansar for research into the mechanisms that cells use to repair DNA. Can you tell our audience a bit about your specific work?
Yeah, so my specific work has dealt with repair of damage to DNA that occurs spontaneously or because we have water in our cells that slowly degrades the DNA. Yeah? And there's not very much we can do about it except repair the DNA. So once you know that the DNA decays much faster than people had believed before, the logical conclusion is that you have to patch it up, and that means that there are special mechanisms that people hadn't looked for before, special enzymes that have evolved to repair our DNA, and without them it will be very hard to have organized life in higher organisms.
So you were one of the first people to work out this mechanism in DNA?
I think so, yes. So are the other, my colleagues here are well-known scientists in the DNA repair field, mm-hmm. and Paul Modrich is a personal friend, so it's a small field.
Yeah.
We have met each other at meetings at many years.
And can you tell us a little bit how you think others have gone on to use the work that you did?
The field has grown. When I started worrying about DNA repair mechanisms, it was a small field. Of, I dare say, sometimes mixed quality. So the standards have improved, and there are more people working on it, and there's some very exciting work done now by the different prize winners, among others, and co-workers.
Is there any particular work that you're particularly excited about at the moment?
Yes, in that it turns out that once I had found out that DNA slowly decomposes, it doesn't decompose by just one mechanism. We have many small molecules in our cells, and they can all damage DNA here. And for most of them, we really don't know what's going on. Is it so important that they actually damage the DNA in our cells? If so, there must be unknown repair mechanisms that deal with that damage. So it's a whole new field that's opening up here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you are working on at the moment?
Well, I've retired. I don't have a wet lab anymore, so my work now is on the level of discussion with scientists and advice. But I am a senior scientific advisor at IFOM, that's the Molecular Oncology Laboratory in Milan, I think the best research lab in Italy, that is a very exciting job, and I like interacting with my Italian colleagues, and as you say, that keeps me on my toes a bit.
The Royal Society's current president, Sir Paul Nurse, famously bought a motorbike with some of his Nobel Prize money in 2001. Have you given any thought to how you might spend your share of the prize?
Yes, but there won't be a motorbike. I like good wine, so I might buy myself a couple of very good cases of wine to drink.
And lastly, do you have any advice for young scientists who might aspire to win their own Nobel Prizes one day?
Try to find something unusual to work on. There are many topical areas, but they are also crowded with bright young people. Gamble and go into an area that's not overpopulated already. That's what I did. Nobody was interested in DNA decomposition when I started on that.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us, and congratulations again.
Thank you, Vivian.
Some handy tips there at the end for any aspiring Nobel Prize winners.
The Royal Society's medals and awards are now open for nominations, and you can find out more on our website by visiting royalsociety.org/awards.
That's all for this month's episode. We upload a new episode of Our Science every month, so if you're interested in staying up to date with our latest podcasts, please subscribe to Our Science on iTunes or keep an eye out on our Twitter feed at Royal Society for the next episode.
Join us in the new year for the next episode of Our Science, a climate special.
Merry Christmas!